sex to present him with items pertaining to his bodily functions. And anyway, a tube of toothpaste or a packet of disposable razors did not strike me as very charming gifts. I tried to remember the nicest gift I'd ever received. Apart from Polly the plant, I couldn't think of anything. Alarmingly, Declan came into my mind. My first and only boyfriend. I'd very nearly succeeded in erasing him from my memory altogether, so it was rather distressing to be reminded of him. I recalled an incident when, on seeing the single birthday card I'd received one year from a journalist who'd somehow managed to track me down with a note inside reminding me that she'd pay a substantial sum for an interview any time, anywhere, he claimed that I deliberately hadn't told him the date of my birthday. For my 21st birthday gift, he therefore punched me in the kidneys, kicked me as I lay on the floor until I passed out, and then gave me a black eye when I came round for withholding information. The only other birthday I could recall was my 11th. I received a sterling silver bracelet from the foster family I was living with at the time, with a teddy bear charm attached. I was very grateful to receive a present, but I didn't ever wear it. I'm not really a teddy bear sort of person. I wondered what sort of gift the handsome singer might give me for an anniversary, say, or for Christmas. No, wait, for Valentine's Day, the most special romantic day of the year. He'd write a song for me, something beautiful, and then play it for me on his guitar while I sipped perfectly chilled champagne. No, not on his guitar, that was too obvious. He'd surprise me by learning the bassoon. Yes, he'd play the melody on the bassoon for me. Back to more prosaic matters. For want of anything more suitable, I bought some newspapers and magazines for Sammy, thinking that I could at least read them aloud to him. They stocked a passable selection. From his appearance and the contents of his shopping bag, I divined that Sammy was more Daily Star than Daily Telegraph. I bought a few tabloids and decided to take him a magazine too. That was more difficult. There were so many. Condé Nast Traveller, Yachts and Yachting Now. How would I know which one to choose? I had no idea what interested him. I thought carefully and rationally in order to deduce the answer. The only thing I knew for sure about him was that he was an adult male. Anything else would be pure speculation. I went with the law of averages, stood on tiptoe, and reached up for a copy of Razzle. Job done. It was too hot inside the hospital and the floor squeaked. There was a hand gel dispenser outside the ward, and a big yellow sign above it read, "Do not drink." Did people actually drink sanitizing hand gel? I suppose they must, hence the sign. Part of me, a very small sliver, briefly considered dipping my head to taste a drop, purely because I'd been ordered not to. No, Eleanor, I told myself, curb your rebellious tendencies. Stick to tea, coffee and vodka. I was apprehensive about using it on my hands for fear that it might inflame my eczema, but I did so nonetheless. Good hygiene is so important. Heaven forfend that I would end up becoming a vector of infection. The ward was large, with two long rows of beds, one down each wall. All the inhabitants were interchangeable, hairless, toothless old men who were either dozing or staring blankly ahead, chins slumped forwards. I spotted Sammy, right at the end on the left-hand side, but only because he was fat. The rest of them were bones draped with pleated grey skin. I sat down on the vinyl, wipe-clean chair next to his bed. There was no sign of Raymond. Sammy's eyes were closed, but he obviously wasn't comatose. He would be in a special ward if that were the case, hooked up to machinery, wouldn't he? I wonder why Raymond had lied about it. I could tell from the regular way that Sammy's chest rose and fell that he was sleeping. I decided not to read to him, not wishing to wake him. And so I put the reading material on the top of the cabinet next to his bed. I opened the compartment at the front, thinking it best to deposit the bags for life inside. The cabinet was empty apart from a wallet and a set of keys. I wondered if I should look in Sammy's wallet to see if it contained any clues about him, and I was about to reach forward for it when I heard someone clear their throat behind me, a phlegm-filled sound that indicated a smoker. "Eleanor, you came," said Raymond, pulling up a chair on the opposite side of the bed. I stared at him. "Why did you lie, Raymond? Sammy's not in a coma, he's merely asleep. That's not the same thing at all." Raymond laughed. "Oh, but it's great news, Eleanor. He woke up a couple of hours ago. Apparently he's got severe concussion and a broken hip. They reset it yesterday. He's very tired from the anaesthetic, but they say he's going to be fine." I nodded and stood up abruptly.
"We should leave him in peace then," I said.
I was keen to be out of the ward, to be frank. It was too hot and too familiar. The waffle blankets, the chemical and human smells, the hard surfaces of the metal bed frame and the plastic chairs. My hands were stinging slightly from the gel, which had seeped into the cracks in my skin. We walked together to the lift and rode down in silence. The doors opened at the ground floor and I felt my legs speed up of their own accord towards the front door. It was one of those beautiful midsummer evenings, 8 o'clock and still full of heat and soft light. It wouldn't get dark till almost 11. Raymond took off his jacket, revealing another ridiculous T-shirt. This one was yellow and had two white cartoon cockerels on the front. "Los Polos Hermanos," it said, nonsensical. He looked at his watch. "I'm going to pick up a carry-out and head round to my mate Andy's. A few of us usually hang out there on Saturday nights, fire up the PlayStation, have a smoke and a few beers."
"Sounds utterly delightful," I said.
"What about you?" he asked. I was going home, of course, to watch a television programme or read a book. What else would I be doing?
"I shall return to my flat," I said. "I think there might be a documentary about Komodo dragons on BBC 4 later this evening." He looked at his watch again and then up at the boundless blue sky.
There was a moment of silence, and then a blackbird began showing off nearby, his song so spectacular that it bordered on vulgar. We both listened, and when I smiled at Raymond, he smiled back. "Look, it's far too nice a night to be sitting inside on your own. Fancy grabbing a quick pint somewhere? I'll need to head off in an hour or so before the office shuts, but..."
This required careful consideration. I had not been in a public house for many years, and Raymond could hardly be described as engaging company. I quickly concluded, however, that it would be useful for two reasons. Firstly, it would be good practice, as, if things went well, Johnny Lomond would probably want to take me to a public house during one of our dates, and so I really ought to familiarise myself in advance with the general environs and required behaviours in such establishments. Secondly, Raymond was an IT expert, allegedly, and I needed some advice. Such advice might be expensive to obtain via official channels, but I could ask him tonight, for free. All things considered, it seemed expeditious to accede to Raymond's request. He was staring into the middle distance, and I noticed that he had lit a cigarette and smoked almost half of it while I had been pondering. "Yes, Raymond, I will go to the pub with you for one drink," I said, nodding.
"Magic," he said.
We ended up in a bar 5 minutes from the hospital on a busy road. One of the tables outside was unoccupied. The metal surface was covered in circular stains and its legs looked unstable, but Raymond seemed delighted.
"Seats outside," he said, happily throwing himself down and hanging his jacket over the back of his chair. "Right then, I'll go to the bar," he said. "What are you after, Eleanor?"
I felt a fluttering of concern in my stomach.
Firstly, sitting out here, I wouldn't get to see the inside of the public house and observe what went on there. Secondly, I didn't know what to order. What did normal people drink in public houses? I decided to take control of the situation. "Raymond, I will go to the bar. I insist. What would you like me to order for you?" He tried to argue, but I stood my ground and eventually he agreed, although he seemed annoyed. I simply could not fathom why he was making such a fuss about it. "Right, well, I suppose I'll have a pint of Guinness then. But I wish you'd let me get it, Eleanor." I put both hands on the table and leaned forward so that my face was very close to his. "Raymond, I will purchase the drinks. It's important to me for reasons that I don't wish to articulate to you.
He shrugged, then nodded, and I walked off towards the door. It seemed very dark inside after the sunlight, and noisy too. There was music of an unfamiliar genre pulsing loudly from large speakers. The place wasn't busy, and I was the only customer at the bar. A young man and a young woman were serving. That is to say, they were deep in conversation with each other, and every so often she would giggle like a simpleton and flick her dyed yellow hair, or he would punch her arm playfully and laugh in an overly loud, false manner. Human mating rituals are unbelievably tedious to observe. At least in the animal kingdom, you are occasionally treated to a flash of bright feathers or a display of spectacular violence. Hair flicking and play fights don't quite cut the mustard. I was bored, and I knocked hard 3 times on the wooden bar, as though it were a front door. They both looked up. I asked for a pint of Guinness, which the boy began to pour from a tap. "Anything else?" he said. I was still stumped. I reasoned that part of his job would be to help customers in such situations. "What would you recommend?" I asked him. He looked up from watching the black liquid trickle into the glass. "Eh?" I said, "What would you recommend for me? I don't drink in public houses, as a rule." He looked to his left and right, as if expecting someone else to be standing there. There was a long pause. He said, "Well, Magners is very popular, with ice. Nice summer drink." "Right," I said, "thank you. In that case, I'll have a Magners drink, please, on your recommendation." He opened a brown bottle and put it on the bar. He put some ice in a tall glass and placed it next to the bottle. "What's that?" I said. "The Magners." "And what's the empty glass for?"
"It's for the Magners," he said.
"Am I expected to pour the drink from the bottle into the glass?" I said, puzzled. "Isn't it your job to do that?" He stared at me and then slowly poured the brown liquid over the ice and put it down quite hard. Indeed, he practically slammed the bottle onto the counter.
£8.70, he said in a most unfriendly manner.
I handed over a £5 note and £4 coins, then took my change and carefully put it in my purse. "Would you by any chance have a tray?" I asked. He tossed down a filthy, sticky tray and watched as I placed the drinks on it before turning his back on me. There is such a paucity of good manners on display in the so-called service sector. Raymond thanked me for the drink and took a big gulp. The Magners was quite pleasant, and I revised my opinion of the young barman. Yes, his customer service skills were poor, but he did at least know how to make appropriate beverage recommendations. Unprompted, Raymond started to tell me about his mother, how he was going to visit her tomorrow, something he did every Sunday. She was a widow and not terribly well. She had a lot of cats and he helped her care for them. On and on and on he droned. I interrupted him. "Raymond," I said, "can I ask you something?" He sipped his pint.
"Sure."
"If I were to purchase a smartphone, which type would you advise? I have been looking into the relative merits of iPhones as compared with Android devices, and I'd appreciate an insider's perspective on the cost-benefit ratio, as it were." He looked somewhat surprised at my question, which was odd, given that he worked in IT and therefore must be asked technological questions quite frequently.
"Right, well..."
He shook his head in a slightly canine way, as though he were clearing thoughts from it.
"Well, that depends on a lot of factors."
He expounded on these factors at some length without reaching any kind of useful conclusion, and then looked at his watch.
"Shit, I better run. I need to pick up some beers before I head over to Andy's, and it's nearly 10.
He drained his pint, stood up and put on his jacket, even though it wasn't in the least bit cold.
"You going to be okay getting home, Eleanor?"
he said. "Oh, yes," I said. "I'll walk. It's such a beautiful evening and it's still light."
"Right then, I'll see you on Monday," he said. "Enjoy the rest of your weekend."
He turned to leave. "Raymond, wait," I said. He turned back towards me, smiling.
What is it, Eleanor?
The Guinness, Raymond. It was £3.50.
He stared at me.
It's okay, I said. There's no rush. You can give it to me on Monday if that's easier.
He counted out £4 coins and put them on the table.
Keep the change, he said, and walked off. Extravagant.
I put the money in my purse and finished my Magners. Emboldened by the apples, I decided to take a detour on the way home. Yes, why not? It was time for a spot of reconnaissance.
Chapter 8. There is no such thing as hell, of course, but if there was, then the soundtrack to the screaming, the pitchfork action and the infernal wailing of damned souls would be a looped medley of show tunes drawn from the annals of musical theatre. The complete oeuvre of Lloyd Webber and Rice would be performed, without breaks, on a stage inside the fiery pit, and an audience of sinners would be forced to watch and listen for eternity. The very worst amongst them, the child molesters and the murderous dictators, would have to perform them. Save for the exquisite oeuvre of a certain Mr. Lomond, I have yet to find a genre of music I enjoy. It's basically audible physics, waves and energised particles, and like most sane people, I have no interest in physics. It therefore struck me as bizarre that I was humming a tune from Oliver. I mentally added the exclamation mark, which for the first time ever was appropriate. Who will buy this wonderful evening? Who indeed? One of the foster carers kept a video library of musicals that we worked our way through en famille at weekends. And so, although I fervently wish that I wasn't, I'm very familiar with the work of Lionel Bart, Rodgers and Hammerstein et al. Knowing I was here on the street where he lived was giving me a funny feeling, fluttery and edgy, verging on euphoric. I could almost understand why that frock-coated buffoon from My Fair Lady had felt the need to bellow about it outside Audrey Hepburn's window. Finding out where the musician lived had been easy. He had posted a picture of a lovely sunset on Twitter.
At Johnny Aylrock's. The view from my window. How lucky am I? Hashtag summer in the city. Hashtag blessed.
It showed rooftops, trees and sky, but there was also a pub in the corner of the photograph, right at the end of the street, its name clearly visible. I found it in seconds, thanks to Google. The street, like most in this part of the city, was made up of tenements. They all had a secure main front door with named buzzers on the outside wall, one for each flat inside the building. This was the right street. Which side should I start with? Even numbers, I decided. He was an even sort of man, not an odd one. I had a puzzle to solve. I hummed as I worked, and couldn't remember the last time I'd felt like this, light, sparkly, quick. I suspected that it might be what happiness felt like. It was fascinating to see all the different names on the buzzers, and the manner in which they were displayed. Some were scribbled in biro on a sticker and placed carelessly over the button. Others had typed their names in bold uppercase, printed it out and affixed it with three layers of sellotape. A few had left their buzzer blank or failed to replace their name when the elements had made the ink run, rendering it illegible. I really hoped he wasn't one of those, but I kept a list of their locations in my notebook just in case. If I had eliminated all the legible names without coming across his, I'd have to go back and work my way through the list of blank ones. Ah, but how could I have doubted him? Halfway down the street, the most even of even numbers, there he was. Mr. J. Lomond, Esquire. I stood before the buzzer examining the letters. They were written neatly but artistically in classic black ink on thick white paper. It was so him. It seemed unlikely that he, a popular, handsome man with a world at his feet, would be at home on a Saturday night, so just to see how it felt, I gently touched his buzzer with the tip of my index finger. There was a crackle, and then a man's voice spoke.